Good morning, everyone. Thank you all for coming back from coffee. I'm David Banks. I'm supposed to chair this session and also speak, so there's a clear conflict of interest. Over breakfast this morning, Merlise, Adele, and I were discussing our session today, and we all agreed that we'd drawn the short straw because we're going to have to follow Jerry. And Merlise and Adele felt that our best collective strategy was for me to really lower the audience's expectations so that they would look good following on. And I'll try and do my best on that part. We are here in part because the Statistics and Applied Mathematical Sciences Institute in the Research Triangle Park in North Carolina recently completed a year-long program in data mining. And Hugh was a regular visitor and insightful participant in that, as were many of the other people in this room. And Hugh felt it would be nice to invite us to sort of co-sponsor and also participate in this workshop. So that's why we're here. And my assignment was to talk about scalability in data mining. And that's a very big topic, and this talk is perhaps slightly longer than the time permits. So I'm going to try and do the something old, new, and something borrowed approach. I'm going to talk about three different types of problems in the scalability arena, and it's a much larger arena than I'm going to even begin to touch on. One, simply to fix our ideas, is the old variable selection problem, which was discussed in several talks yesterday. Model selection, which is a much harder problem and which Merlise will say a little bit more about. And then finally, data subsetting, which I think is just a fun idea that's cool to talk about. If you cast your mind back to the early days of master's graduate classes, there was a whole batch of stuff about how one does variable selection and simple linear regression, and it was pretty clear that it's a hard, hard problem. If you have a lot of potential explanatory variables and not an ocean of data, then you're going to have real trouble trying to do any of the classical variable selection techniques in an effective way. In fact, they all break down for sort of p bigger than 10 or less. So what you would like to do is think about alternative ways for handling variable selection strategies. And one that is just sort of a generic idea for expanding the scope of one's search is to consider the use of gray codes. The application here is quite simple and quite specific, simply to be concrete, but you could apply the same strategy to doing variable selection in Mars or doing certain kinds of model selection and other stuff. So imagine that you have p explanatory variables, each of which may be included or not included in the model, and so you're considering 2 to the p possible models that you might want to think about. And each of those models is, of course, identifiable with a binary string of length p containing zeros or ones, depending on whether or not that set of variables is in the model or out of the model. And clearly, each of those strings can also be identified with a vertex of the unit hypercube in p space. And so from this perspective, one thing you would like to do is imagine that you can smartly explore the vertices of this unit hypercube. And there are a couple of different ways that one might do that. One is simply to walk around all the vertices of the unit hypercube, stopping at each one, fitting your model, looking at the R squared or the star IC criterion or whatever you think is the right way to measure the fit there. And one particularly smart way to walk around the vertices of the unit hypercube is the gray code. This is an algorithm for walking around the vertices of the unit hypercube without ever visiting the same vertex twice, but it has some other nice properties as well. It tends to move locally before it moves globally. In order to apply this sort of search strategy, you don't want to stop at every single vertex along the way, because clearly that's going to be 2 to the p, and that's too much. But what you can do is, in principle, is take very long steps. All of the possible vertices that you might visit are in the gray code list. And you start off with your starting point, you go to the next one, the next one, the next one. And so you take big steps along this list, and if the vertices are sort of well separated on the hypercube, then you're exploring the hypercube in a relatively efficient way. So you might take R to be about 1/1000th of 2 to the p, And so you're going to be doing 1,000 fits rather than 2 to the P fits. And those 1,000 fits are going to be very well distributed over the hypercube. Here you've got, I apologize for the light green. It's darker green everywhere else, but not on the projector. If you have a gray code, the first column, 0, 1, 2, 3, up to 15, tells you which order you visit the vertex. The next row is the binary rank, which will turn out to be useful later, that we're just writing the rank of the list in binary. And the third is the vertex string that you visit. And you'll notice the binary rank and the vertex string are not the same. There are two theorems that make this search strategy somewhat practical. The first is the ranking theorem, which says that you can generate the entire list sort of automatically. You can call out a number, 4,706, and I can quickly calculate what is the 4,706th vertex in the gray code list without actually having to walk across all of the vertices to find it constructively. So I've got a system for going to a particular point on the list and just looking there, and that's nice. If you didn't have that, then you wouldn't be able to make this an effective search strategy. You wouldn't be able to get away from the problem of walking over the entire cube. The other thing is Ewen's theorem. Ewen's theorem says that in a precise way that the gray code walks locally before it makes a big steps. And so it says that if the Hamming distance between the two vertex strings is greater than or equal to k, then the difference in their ranks in their gray code lists is at least 2k over 3 integer thereof, which basically means if you take big steps on the gray code list, you're taking big steps in the Hamming code metric. And that ensures that you're exploring widely. This type of approach is very much like leaps and bounds and other ways of sort of, you know, exploring widely. And there are various modifications to the gray code that you could try when your P is so large that even this is going to fall on its sword. The idea is that you would probably look for hotspots, regions where your DIC or Watanabe's criterion or whatever you like best as a goodness of fit measure is high, and then when you find that, you search locally around that in a more sort of filling in the gray code there. So as a general strategy, this is a way that you can search complicated models in a way that's better than trying to do the stepwise selection. You need to have some version of Ewen's theorem, and that does not, gray codes don't exist just for unit hypercubes. They also exist for trees and lots of other combinatorial structures. So if you're doing some sort of model search and you have combinatorial structure that you can exploit, then there's a chance that you can use the gray code to achieve better search or wider search. In order to make that work, you need to have some version of Ewen's theorem, which says that you look locally before you look globally, and you also need some version of the ranking theorem, or the inverse ranking theorem, actually, so that you can take a number on the list and quickly find the corresponding combinatorial structure. And those don't exist for everything, but they exist for many types of combinatorial structures. Some of them are just open problems. Another way to go after this is entirely trivial, and I'm almost embarrassed to mention this in this audience, but nonetheless, it's probably worth pointing out just as sort of a good operational practice. If you are trying to find the model that maximizes some goodness of fit criterion, then what you might do is do a lot of random restarts, and then you can use basic probability theory to tell you what is the probability that your next random restart search is going to find a new local maximum. You can estimate the number of undiscovered local maxima based on this. If you've done 100 restarts and you've always found the same maximum, then probably there's only one maximum. Or you can use Laplace's law of succession to figure out how many maxima there might be. If, however, you've started 100 random restarts and each time you found a different local maximum, then you're on a really pocky surface and you're going to have a lot of trouble trying to do well there. Another idea is due to my colleague Merlis, and it's basically the type of thing that a statistician ought to think about first, which is to regard variable selection problems as experimental designs. You've got P variables, whether they're in or out or two levels of the design, and then you can try and construct a highly fractionated factorial experiment to determine whether or not each variable is on its own significant main order, main effects, or whether or not there are interactions between them. Clearly, this is going to break down very, very badly as P gets large, and you can't really take a large enough fraction to be able to estimate as much as you need to. But it is the type of strategy that statisticians ought to think about. And there are smart experimental designs, orthogonal arrays and Latin hypercubes and so forth, that might extend the reach of this a little bit. So that is also something that practicing statisticians ought to consider. My visiting colleague, Bertrand Clark, is into list search. And list search is what you might use when you don't really have very much structure in the search. In the variable selection problem, we had sort of a unit hypercube sitting in the background. But for other types of problems, where you're simply trying to fit some model, and there could be many, many different models, and there's no natural priority, you sort of start off thinking that you just have a very long list of things that you want to fit, and you're not quite sure how to do that well. The brute force approach is to simply try everything on the list, but the list can be very long, and that's the hard part of it. There is a wonderful idea that's due to Andrew Moore, and I certainly hope that most of the people in the room know about it, but some don't, and it is a salutary lesson for statisticians about pride and falls, because this is a beautifully simple idea, and it was something that would never have occurred to a statistician. What Andrew Moore suggested was that if you want to compare two models on your list in a list search, a statistician, of course, would fit the data to both models, determine which model had the best fit, take the model with the best fit, and move to the third element of the list, compare those two, and work down the list in this way until eventually all the models were compared and you had found the best model. And Andrew Moore simply pointed out that, you know, you really don't have to fit all of the data most of the time. Usually a random 1% of the data or 0.5% of the data will be completely sufficient to discriminate a good model from a bad model. And so if you just sort of only fit sort of the minimum few percent necessary to eliminate a bad model, then for the same amount of computational effort, you can extend the reach of your search by a factor of about 100. And so it's a really trivial idea, but it's the type of thing that computer scientists think about and statisticians don't. Another strategy in sort of Bertrand's language is to try and find ways to structure the list. If you have a list of things that don't have an apparent geometric structure like a hypercube or a tree to exploit, maybe there's some other way of imposing structure upon that. You can perhaps set up a neighborhood structure in which you look at the distance between the models based on the number of variables they have in common, or some measure of the type of fit they have, or some measure of their complexity, and try and once you impose the structure, then you can use some of the search strategies that we've talked about earlier, such as random restart, to maybe do better. So if you can get a neighborhood structure any way at all, if it's reasonably decent, if it's even approximately decent, that should help you. People talk about using simulated annealing, and I'm not that keen on it, so I'm not going to say much about that. Some of my friends believe in genetic algorithms, and I have to find that they are a great puzzlement to me. It's very hard for me to imagine any except a relatively small set of circumstances under which genetic algorithms ought to work. Really, genetic algorithms are tuned to solve problems when good solutions can be built by assembling inferior solutions together in the right way. And that's a fairly special structure, but and many problems don't have that. And as an example of a problem that surely would not have that property, think about finding a new experimental design that has, you know, de-optimality and some special additional constraints or something like that. So finding an experimental design with special properties is really hard because you remove one observation and you completely break the careful symmetry that makes the whole thing work. And so it ought to completely fall apart and be a disaster. So it looks very hard to assemble good designs from inferior designs in any principled way. So that would be a problem that I would not expect genetic algorithms to work well upon. But, remarkably, people have found very nice experimental designs using really, I think, dumb genetic algorithm techniques, and this puzzles me. So apparently there is more traction going on with the genetic algorithms than I have been able to understand, and so I throw this out as yet another search strategy that has its own coterie of devotees that really pursue it, but I don't know that I can advocate it until I understand it better. The list search is something I am going to skip because I've already said about as much as I want to say on lists anyway, and there's not real value there. I want to move on to cherry picking. Very often when you have complex data sets, a significant fraction of the data are wrong, spurious, misleading, outliers, or another, some other way, just so bad that you wouldn't want to include it when you build your model. And as one example that you might imagine, we're going to talk about a toy example in which 40% of the data follow one linear model, 30% of the data follow another, and 30% of the data are just all noise. And you'd like to figure out how you might mine structure in that situation. The classical approach in statistics when you have a significant fraction of bad data is to think about S estimators. And in the context of regression, for example, the idea with an S estimator for regression is that you would try and find the thinnest ruler that fits over 50% of the data. And that thin, the center line of that thin ruler represents the very robust regression estimate for the line in that problem. And clearly you can do really bad things to 49 plus a bit of the data and still 49% of the data and you'll still be able to find the best 50% fraction and fit the line that way. The problem with S estimation, of course, is that it still breaks down in higher dimensions. It's got a breakdown point that depends on the dimensionality. You have covariance matrices that you want to estimate, and those get hard as well. And it doesn't model, and it doesn't carry over to sort of arbitrarily hard problems in data mining. You can't do multidimensional scaling with it. You can't fit a Mars model to it that I know about. And so there are lots of things you would like to be able to do, but you don't have a nice way of ignoring 49% of your data in a principled way. Also, of course, you have situations where it may be that only 30% of the data really follows an interesting structure and the other 70% doesn't. And so you'd like to be able to handle that type of thing. Here is an example worked up. As you see, we have two linear regression lines there. And in two dimensions, it's easy to sort that out, and nobody would have any problem doing this. But if you had similar structures in a high-dimensional space, perhaps involving more explanatory variables in the regressions, then it would be very, very hard to untangle this. And if you sort of chugged along in a naive way and just sort of fit things, you're going to wind up with a line that sort of misses the point of both of the signals there. But the cherry-picking algorithm says, okay, let me try to find a simple model for which a large percentage of the data show a lot of good fit. And so we'll start off with fitting a linear regression, and we want to imagine that Q percent of the data follow the model. We have regression parameters beta and sigma are unknown, and I'm going to simply imagine that Q percent of the data are good, the rest are bad, and Q can be something small, say 20 or 30%, and it will still work very nicely. What we want to do is we want to start with a small subset of good observations and then sequentially add the best observations to that growing our subsamples of data until we cannot add any new data without really hammering the fit in a bad way. So we're going to start with a sample of good observations, we're going to add good observations, and at the end we hope we'll grow this as big as we can. Obviously you have to be lucky in picking your initial subsample. And since we can't count on being lucky, we're going to pick a lot of subsamples. We're going to grow each of them. Some of the subsamples will contain good and bad data, data that correspond to one regression line plus data from the other regression line. For those starting point subsamples, we'll never be able to do very well, and we won't be able to grow it very large. Other subsamples will contain only good data, and those are the ones that we can grow to be quite appreciably large. How you do that can be tuned up in various ways, but the key thing is if you want to figure out how many starting point subsamples you want to have, you ought to make some guess about what fraction of your data are really good. And for many applications, that's not unreasonable. I used to work for the federal government, and it became quite clear that they were lucky if 20% of the data that were collected from some of their surveys were good. But if you believe that 20% was good, you could work with that that constraint. So you go through, you pick the number of starting point subsamples you need according to this equation, which is almost invisible to the people in the back, but it's a simple calculation. You basically simply want to know what you're to do a regression, you need to have 3 observations before you can calculate any type of goodness of fit measure. So you need to think about what is the chance of getting 3 observations, how many starting point subsamples do you need in order to be, say, 95% sure that at least one of your starting samples of 3 contains only good data. And that's a simple calculation, and it's not especially interesting. For our data set, it turned out that we just needed to have 5 starting point subsamples in order to make sure that that happened. Time is short, and I'd like to move on to the next one. I will note that if you have a large data set, you want to do a fast search and a slow search. The fast search picks the cherries greedily, and then after you've gotten to a reasonably large size, you pick the cherries more selectively. And there are different ways you can do that, and I regard that as tactics rather than strategy. One important thing to know in trying to employ this is you need to figure out what is the appropriate goodness fit criterion that you want, and it should not depend upon P, the number of variables that you use. Similarly, you want to be able to figure out what is the minimum number of observations you need in order to meaningfully calculate that lack of fit. Here we have a graph that shows what happens as we keep adding data, and about the time 70 observations were generated exactly on one of the lines, and clearly as soon as we add the 71st observation, the goodness of fit gets really bad. So you can plot this, look for a knee in the curve, and that, use that as your basis for stopping the cherry picking process. The very last thing I wanted to say on this subject was to show that you could use it for something more interesting than just simple linear regression. In multidimensional scaling, for example, you want to try and find the points that fit the surface well. The canonical example of multidimensional scaling is you have the intercity drive times. So you have a proximity measure on all the different pairs of cities in the United States. You toss that into multidimensional scaling, and multidimensional scaling will come back with a map of the United States in some random orientation because it doesn't know about north, south, east, or west, but it will preserve the relative distances between the cities pretty well. It doesn't account for curvature of the road, but it will try and find a Euclidean space that represents the cities as well as possible with respect to the intercity drive times. The difficulty, of course, arises if you get a flat tire between a couple of cities and it takes hours and hours to get from Durham to Raleigh. And in that case, it looks like Raleigh is off on some wild peninsula sitting out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and the stress of the multidimensional scaling solution gets really bad because it has to distort the map in big ways in order to make the fit. For the example that Leanna House ran, we had the latitudes and longitudes of 90 Eastern U.S. cities, 99 Eastern U.S. cities. We worked out she contaminated some of those intercity distances with bad data, flat tires, and she increased those distances by either 150% or 500%, and you can see the effect on the stress in the last column. Clearly, when you start to add that type of noise, it gets really bad. And in multidimensional scaling can handle one or two outliers, not in an interpretable way. But as soon as you start to have more than that, the map gets so distorted that you just lose all the structure. It would be far better to have a nice multidimensional scaling solution that explains well 70 of the cities out of 99 and threw away the 29 that it could not deal well with, rather than try and force them all into the same plot. So Leanna wanted to show off, so she wanted to use the Kruskal-Shepard non-metric scaling simply to prove that you didn't have to do anything simple-minded like least squares. And when all is said and done, she was able to generate a solution of this kind. The final stresses were small. You needed to have your starting point subsamples had to be of size 4, because you need to have 4 points on a plane before you can calculate a stress. All the starting point subsamples had to be of size 4. I think she had to have 15 starting point subsamples in order to have 95% chance that at least one of the starting point samples only had good data in it. Here you see the stress as a function of the number of observations that get added, and about the time you reach the 75th observation, the stress starts to go through the roof. So again, you have a very clear knee in the curve there, and you don't want to go beyond that. I will be doing a disservice to my colleagues if I speak for much longer. I guess this is the conclusion. The cherry-picking strategy represents... Oh. No. You're the type of person who puts on their shoes when the preacher says, you know, and now, in conclusion. It doesn't work that way. This is a good strategy for trying to handle data sets with lots and lots of bad signal in it. It's a simple-minded strategy, so I think it has some potential for practical application in the federal government or businesses or other types of applications. Search is computer intensive, but not hard. It's conceptually easy to implement. And then there are other things I want to say about making probabilistic statements. I've said everything I want to say. You can put on your shoes. Thank you all very much, and we're going to do a quick swap from my